Okay, ready?
Okay.
This is Radiolab.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you start. Yeah.
Okay. This is Radiolab.
Today we're talking about loops.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Jad Abumrad. This is Radiolab.
It's all about loops.
Yep, I'm Jad.
And I'm Robert. You're listening to Radiolab.
Today we're talking about loops.
I'm Robert.
I'm Jad.
And it's all about loops.
Yep, I'm Jad.
And I'm Robert.
We're talking about loops.
And speaking of things that happen over and over and over again on this show here.
Hello.
Here he is again.
Hi, Jad.
Hey, Steve.
Steven Strogatz.
How are you? Mathematician.
Cornell University.
How's it going?
I'm good.
And Steve told us a story about a mathematical loop.
That threw mathematicians all over the world.
For? A loop. The story starts way back with a guy named...
Gottlob Frege.
Gottlob Frege? How do you spell
yeah,
Gottlob?
Yeah, it's not Gottlieb. It seems to be L-O-B at the end, unless it's a typo in every book I've ever seen.
Now, to set this up very quickly, Gottlob Frege was a mathematician back in the 1870s and 80s, and he had a dream that mathematics could unlock the secrets of the universe, that you could maybe even build a machine, feed it some basic mathematical rules, and it would just start churning out discoveries.
Wouldn't even need a human being.
That's how powerful he thought math could be.
But that led him to a question. If math is the most fundamental thing in the universe, what is the most fundamental part
of math?
What's at the foundation? Is it numbers? Is it, you know, 1, 2, 3?
Well, that's what you would think.
But Gottlob...
He said, no, there's a deeper thing than numbers. The deepest thing of all is what today we call sets, the set of things, you know.
A set.
Yeah, so like what's a set? You know, you could...
Steve explained it to us using, of all things, Sesame Street.
Really old episode.
As far as just to set it up here, it's two people working at the Furry Arms Hotel. There's Humphrey.
All right, Ingrid.
Who's got a green nose and a pink face. And his girlfriend, I don't actually know what she is. She might be his wife, Ingrid. And so they're hotel keepers, and Ernie is in the background.
Oh, hold on.
And so Ingrid and Humphrey are taking an order.
Yeah, how may I help you?
Room service order from a room full of penguins.
We're hungry.
You know, Humphrey says, I'll take your order, Mr. Penguin, sir.
What would you like?
A fish.
Fish?
A fish.
Fish?
Fish.
Fish?
Fish.
Fish, fish.
Then Humphrey says, let me check if I got that right.
Fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish, fish.
You got it!
And then he calls over to Ingrid, who's going to call it into the kitchen. So he tells Ingrid,
fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish, fish.
And Ingrid says, fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish.
No.
And Humphrey says, no, that's not right.
Because
she only says it 5 times. But then Ernie explains.
Excuse me, Ingrid and Humphrey, I have a better way for you to do this.
A better way?
Mm-hmm. Count the fish.
Fish?
1.
Fish?
2.
Fish?
3.
And
4. 5. 6 fish.
Holy mackerel!
They both realize, Ingrid and Humphrey, how powerful this is. And they say, does it
work
for
other stuff? Say, cinnamon rolls?
Yep. Spark plugs?
Plugs?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Wow!
That's the point, that what cinnamon buns and spark plugs and fish, the sets, have in common is that there are 6 in each. Right? I mean, if you try to say, what does 6 really mean? It's the thing that those sets have in common.
According to Steve, it's not so much the number 6 that's important here.
Yeah, that's just a label for this characteristic that all these piles seem to share.
It's the pile itself, the set.
That is the most basic thing.
So Frege said,
holy mackerel!
Well, this is it. Sets are...
the bedrock.
...that I've been looking for.
Yeah, we can build the rest of math on top of it.
Yeah, and then I can make my math machine that'll solve the universe.
And I think he published a book sort of showing how this might work. Except that Russell,
Bertrand Russell, the mathematician,
then found a devastating paradox that ended up, well, annihilating what Frege had tried to do.
Russell's paradox has now become known as
the Barber paradox.
It's a little thought experiment. So in this case, the set is a town.
Yep.
A town with people.
Yep.
One barber.
With the following rules.
In this town, the barber shaves everyone who doesn't shave himself.
The barber
sounds reasonable, right?
Everyone who doesn't shave himself.
So some people shave themselves, some people go to the barber. Right.
That's the universe. We're in a town where everyone who doesn't shave himself is shaven by this barber. And now the question is, who shaves the barber?
Who shaves?
Remember, the barber has the property that he shaves everyone who doesn't shave himself. So
yeah.
He can't shave himself.
Ah.
But on the other hand...
Couldn't he?
If he doesn't shave himself, then he's one of those people who doesn't shave himself and is therefore shaven by the barber.
Well, maybe the barber... Here's 2 solutions for you guys. The barber could not shave. Couldn't he just not shave?
Maybe.
No.
Or everybody in town shaves.
Maybe he could set up some sort of mechanical device that's sort of like one of those
Goldberg
things.
No, you can't do that. You can't change
You can't
the
answer
rule.
Sensibly what happens to the barber.
And no one has.
There's nothing to say. He either does or doesn't shave himself by ordinary Aristotelian logic because the barber can't shave himself and he can't not shave himself. So there's
and
something.
That's what ruined the machine that would solve the universe.
Wait, but this seems.
I think it could ruin an afternoon. Or you could maybe you have to wait for a couple hours, like after lunch, before you go swimming. But I can't see that like overthrowing all life's work.
It does. It does. It turns out to be very, very problematic for the foundations of math.
Because what this barber paradox, the reason it was so annoying to mathematicians was that math is supposed to be this logical thing, right? Logic is the lifeblood of math. And yet here, you had this little bit of math that was illogical, a
self-contradicting
set.
But Bertrand Russell, the guy who came up with all this, he didn't lose faith. He thought, well, this is just a problem with set theory.
So then he spent a long time trying to make a theory, I think he called it a theory of types instead of sets. And these, he had certain admission rules that he thought would prevent paradoxes from happening.
And for a while, it was looking pretty good under Bertrand Russell's system.
There was no logical problems, no paradoxes. Until.
This scrawny little German guy comes along. And you say his name, Gödel?
I hear it often pronounced, well, I don't speak German, but mathematicians often say it like the woman's piece of clothing, you know, from the old days. But something like Gödel.
Gödel.
So there's a kind of sound in the middle.
Umlaut.
This is Jana.
Jana Levin.
She has written a book about Gödel.
And I'm a professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College.
And she says the point at which Gödel enters our story, it's 1930s Vienna, Austria.
He had just recently finished his, what would be equivalent to like a doctoral degree, a PhD.
Smart dude.
Kind of a rising star. It was no question that people around him understood that.
But he was also maybe a little bit off.
He had real breaks with, you know, reality. He was, in the biographies, they'd call him a paranoid schizophrenic, but he seemed more a kind of obsessive depressive. I don't know if my armchair psychology terms are accurate, but he was in and out of sanatoria, and he had real difficulties being sure what was real.
The only reality he really trusted was math.
Circles.
Shapes.
Prime numbers.
Formulas, axioms.
Right.
And at a certain point, he got into paradoxes. Perhaps it was the barber paradox that lured him in, we don't know. But he began to think about and actually experiment with some of these paradoxical loops.
So he took something like the paradox of the liar. The paradox of the liar says, this statement is a lie.
This statement is a lie.
Right.
Huh.
If it's true, then it's false. And if it's false, then it's true.
This statement is a lie. If you think about that too much, you might explode. You know,
right.
So Gödel was interested in that phrase, and for various reasons, he took it, tweaked it a little bit to come up with
the following statement. This statement is unprovable.
This statement is unprovable.
Which is very important to notice. If it's provable, then it's unprovable.
So obviously, a little bit of a word game, but Gödel thought, forget words. What would happen if I converted this statement into math? Because in math, things are either provable or unprovable. They cannot be both at the same time. It's either true or false. And if it's true, well, then damn it.
You should be able to prove it.
Yeah.
So he said, I'm going to assign a special number, a unique number, to make that a purely mathematical statement by coding it in a very clever way into arithmetic. So
to be honest, we don't completely get this part.
It's very, very clever.
But once he did his mathy stuff, he had a rigorous mathematical statement right there on the page. He looked at it and he realized that what he just said in math
is that the following statement,
this statement is unprovable,
is?
It's true because it's actually unprovable.
Meaning, in math, this statement actually is unprovable. Because it is true, the logic of math will not let you prove that it is true. So it might be true. We'll just never know.
Nothing like that is supposed to happen in math. Things are supposed to be true or not true.
And you're supposed to be able to prove every true thing, says Steve. So if there's something true that you can't prove, that means that the math is strangely, woefully incomplete.
It's always called his incompleteness theorem. That's the phrase. The Gödel incompleteness theorem is that if you have a system of axioms that are consistent, meaning they don't contradict themselves, they're necessarily incomplete. That is, there are certain statements you can make within that system that you can't prove or disprove. And all of math has this character. This is the big shock, that this is not just about word games, about logic puzzles with barbers. This is as devastating for even just counting, for 1, 2, 3, 4. In other words, math is shot through and through with these kind of statements that you can't either prove or disprove. Seriously, the deep thinkers at the time were amazed at this. It was recognized as one of the great ideas of the 20th century, for sure, maybe of all time. I mean, maybe I should make it more concrete. There's a question that, as far as I know, is still not solved.
Steve gave us this example of a problem.
Something called Goldbach conjecture.
That kind of gives you a sense of what incompleteness feels like.
So Goldbach conjecture says that you can always write any even number as a sum of two prime numbers. So let me give you some examples of that. Like, say, 12.
Yeah.
Remember, first of all, prime number means you can divide it by 1 and by itself, like 7 is a prime number. You could divide by 1 and 7, but nothing else.
Okay.
All right. So 12, which is an even number, is 7 plus 5.
Those are
both prime numbers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's try another one. How about 24? That's 11 plus 13.
Right.
Okay. Or 36, 19 plus 17. Any even number. Now, this has been checked out to, I don't know what, billions, trillions, maybe hundreds of trillions. So no one has ever found a counterexample to Goldbach conjecture. And here's the thing. You might think that either it's true or it's false. It might be that this statement, every even number is the sum of two primes, it might be neither true nor false, but what we today call undecidable. Undecidable is a term that comes from Gödel.
Undecidable.
Yeah. I mean, suppose in some ethereal or transcendental sense, like that is, suppose that there's God and God knows that this is true. Then, you know, what about us here among the world of human beings? All we can do is check each even number, and every time we check it's true, that would never constitute a proof because we'd never run out of numbers.
If you then say that to understand everything, you either have to defer to God, who does understand everything if you believe in God, but if you don't believe in God, you then have to live with mystery and not knowing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's all you can say?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say uh-huh. I think you've encapsulated it perfectly, and I think that Gödel himself was, I think, a believer in all kinds of mystical things. Like, for him, this was very freeing and liberating because it meant that that we couldn't be mechanized. There was profound mystery forever.
Hold on. I'm on your team here, but let me just point out something. Gödel, when he died, he was not exactly liberated.
Yeah.
He was a paranoid, like, he thought people were trying to poison him. He starved himself to death. But he wasn't exactly liberated.
Well, but I choose to believe that somewhere in his tortured mind, and I guess his mind was pretty tortured, there was a little fellow humming a song of liberation.
This problem's unsolvable. 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 This problem's unsolvable.
Thanks to Steve Strogatz. He's currently working on a new book, which he calls The Joy of X. Not sex, just X. We don't even know what he's experiencing the joy of.
And so, Jen 11, her book about Gödel is called A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines.
This problem's unsolvable. This problem's unsolvable.
And finally, our last loopy piece.
Yeah, and this one, like the last one, involves things feeding back on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like your classic positive feedback loop.
Which is what exactly?
Well, it's like when you can do it with audio. You take a speaker and a mic, you feed the sound from the speaker into the mic and then back into the speaker and into the mic.
Oh, right.
Then multiplies, and then you get something like...
Painful is what that is.
Yeah,
that's horrible.
Can definitely be painful. But that kind of feedback loop, like in the case of our next story, can also take the pain away.
Yes.
Comes to us from this lady.
I'm Melanie Thernstrom.
She's a writer.
The author of a book on pain called The Pain Chronicles.
Which is a book that began as a chronicling of her own pain, which she's been suffering from
every day
for the last 15 years. And what sort of pain?
Pain in my neck and right shoulder and right side of my head.
In your neck?
All at once?
Yeah, it's all at once.
Did it start with something? Did you hit it there, or how did it start?
It didn't start with an injury of any kind, but it did start at a discreet time.
Goes back to 1997. She was upstate New York at a country house on a date.
It was our first date, and I wanted to impress him. Mm. So I swam across a pond about a mile across.
Was this your idea, or was this his idea?
It was my idea.
Wow, that's a different kind of first date. Yeah. And you made it all the way there and back.
Yes, and nothing happened, but that night,
when she got in the bed,
I was kept awake by this strange burning sensation in my shoulder and neck. I didn't get the head pain for like 4 more years. And that particular pain never went away and got worse over time.
Burning. So it was like a nerve was being...
Yeah, I mean, eventually I got an MRI a couple years later. And there was nerve impingement in my spine. And so there was.
And over the years, she says she's tried everything. She's tried drugs and she's tried physical therapy. She's tried distraction.
Like, I'll go to a matinee, and if it's a scary movie, I just don't stay focused on the pain.
So distraction can work.
But then she says as soon as she gets out of the movie, it's back.
And it's angry for being ignored.
Sometimes I'd have the sensation like that right side of my head was like dying, like the nerves were dying, like a dead tree, and that image would kind of frighten me.
And that thought, she'd find that thought would
make the pain worse. And making the pain worse will inspire further negative fantasies.
Which will make the pain worse.
Which will make the pain worse.
Which will inspire more fantasies.
Yes. So the loop goes.
Positive feedback loop.
Yeah.
In a negative sort of way.
Right. And eventually Melanie decided, okay, I'm going to write a book about this and do some research.
So I was reading a lot about self-inflicted pain in religious rites. And I actually went to witness a Hindi festival, Taipu Sam, in Kuala Lumpur.
And what she saw really changed her mind about things. And you can see video of this festival on YouTube.
What you see is a dense crowd of folks, and in the middle of the crowd, there are these monks doing insane acts of devotion.
They literally, like, thread needles through their tongues, poke skewers through their cheeks, weighted fish hooks dangle from their backs.
And yet, she says, when she would look in their faces, they seemed relaxed.
Like, their eyes don't tear up, they don't gasp for breath.
Like, really relaxed. It wasn't just that they were tolerating the pain. It actually seemed like they weren't
in pain
at all.
And I would think, okay, this person here has a skewer in his mouth. I'm in pain? This is pathetic. You know, and you can't become a religious Hindi in order to experience this analgesic benefit. Like, that's cheating. But I did feel like, okay, so one way to describe it is faith. But for every way that you can describe in religious terms, there's also a way you can describe things in scientific terms.
Yeah. And the reality is all of our pain is in our head.
Which brings us to this guy. This is Sean Mackey,
chief of the Stanford Pain Management Division.
And he will tell you that one of the most basic facts about pain is that it is not purely physical.
We've got signals coming up from the body that are sending us a message.
Like if you whack a toe, the signal shoots up some nerves in your leg, into your spine.
And those signals converge in our brain.
And before you even feel a thing,
there are a multitude of what I refer to as little amplifiers throughout our brain that turn up and turn down the overall pain experience.
And these amplifiers are things like your mood,
anxiety, depression,
attention,
expectations.
All of these things feed back onto that signal coming up from the body, and they can either boost it up, 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 up past a certain point where you get a sensation of pain, or they can deaden it down, 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 down to where you don't feel anything at all. Point is, pain is a conversation between the brain and the body, and Sean thought, what would happen if I actually let people see that conversation? Could they, you know,
take control of it?
Yes.
So he did a study and Melanie signed up.
Mm-hmm.
So describe what happens in this experiment.
So you're put in this MRI machine.
We put somebody into a scanner.
A brain scanner.
And you have a screen in front of you.
And what you see on this screen is something that normally only the researchers would see. You see your own brain In real time?
Yeah.
Well, you're not seeing the whole thing. You're just seeing one piece.
Called the anterior cingulate cortex.
There are many parts of the brain that respond to pain, but that's the one that...
It's an area that has been shown to be involved with pain perception, turning pain up and down.
It's thought to give pain its emotional valence, its negativity.
And do you actually see an image of this little piece of your brain right there in front of you on the screen? I mean, do you actually, are you looking at your brain?
No.
That's confusing to everybody. So instead, we give a visual metaphor.
You see an image of
fire.
Flames.
In an ice cave.
Ooh. Wow.
I mean, it is kind of a cartoon flame, but it looks realistic.
So are these flickering flames? Do they leap into this? Do they
leap?
Yes,
they leap, and the more activation there is in that region, the higher the flames go.
So Melanie is lying in the scanner watching her own pain flames, and Sean gives her a set of instructions.
We say, okay, we want you to imagine that you're sitting in a nice, warm, soothing jacuzzi.
You know, this burning is a warm bath. This burning is very relaxing. I'm relaxing into it.
Yeah. But pretty soon it was like, ha, ha, it's kind of hot. Ha, it's scalding me. Ha, I gotta get out. And before she knew it, the flames were
growing.
So Sean says, okay. So how about your
lying on a beautiful beach?
Yes.
You know, this burning is a pleasant suntan.
And the sand is nice and warm and pleasant.
I'm going to look so good in my new bathing suit if I just keep getting burnt like this.
Yeah, sunburn. Oh, it's getting... All right.
And then the flames would kind of go crazy.
Her thoughts kept slipping out of her control.
You know, if
every time she would see those flames rise, she would think, oh no, the flames are rising, which would make them rise even more and then more and more until she had this bonfire on the screen.
You're immediately struck by they look like the flames where you're going to, the flames where you're burned at the stake. I've been reading a lot of Lives of Saints at that point.
But then Melanie had an idea. She said, why don't I take this negative image and flip it?
And then I started trying to move into the idea of being a saint or a martyr, and that I, you know, believed that I would have no pain and that I was protected by my faith.
And as Melanie started thinking about this, she could see the flames
dying down
just a little bit.
Wow. which is odd, because you don't know me, but this isn't actually like part of my fantasy life.
But she thought, okay, I'll try this.
Let me keep going in that kind of feeling. So I was trying to pick one of the few prayers I knew. I'm half Jewish and half Christian. So I was sort of not settled in onto what kind of martyr I was. You know, I started thinking, shouldn't I really be a Jewish martyr? Since, you know, if you're half Jewish, you know, my mother's Jewish, it's the right side. Really, I'm Jewish more than Christian. And then I started thinking about Jewish martyrs and, like, what prayers do they say?
And as she added and revised details,
that continued to make the flames go down. Okay, I'm in the right brain state. Let me do more of that.
So Melanie finally decided, okay, I'm going to be this one particular Jewish martyr. His name's Akiva ben Joseph. He was burned at the stake by the Romans for teaching the Torah. And there's a particular legend that just as the executioner is about to set fire to the logs right underneath his feet, Akiva stared the executioner in the eyes and smiled. And the executioner was like, why are you smiling? You're about to be burned alive. And Akiva said, all my life, when I said those words, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, I was sad. Because I thought, when shall I be able to fulfill that command? And now that I'm giving my life and my resolution remains firm, why shouldn't I smile?
And by the time Melanie had this fantasy built up in her mind, she looked over at the flames and she noticed they were almost gone.
Like zero, you know, zero pain.
For the first time, she'd taken control of it.
I felt like, wow, I am watching my brain, thinking my thoughts, and I am changing my thoughts by thinking and watching myself do this.
So you are looking at yourself, looking at yourself, looking at yourself, looking at yourself.
Yeah.
It's like peering inside and seeing the ghost in the machine.
I felt, you know, like someone taking their first step on the moon. Like, I am watching my brain, thinking my thoughts. and I am thinking my thoughts, changing my thoughts by thinking and watching my thoughts, watching my brain, changing my thoughts by thinking and watching myself do this.
Well, I need to establish this, that once you were did your two sessions and your in-between exercises, without this all these gizmos, could you address your pain better?
No. Huh. Like, you'd think, well, okay, can't you just get the feedback from your own body? But somehow this sensation isn't quite direct enough that I think that you could do it without the visual feedback.
But for that moment, in that machine?
It was power.
Before we go, a very special thanks to our singers who joined us this hour from the new music ensemble at LaGuardia High School. They are
Kelly Efthimiu,
Julian Soto,
Eli Greenhoe,
Julia Egan, Ruby Froom.
Those guys wrote and performed all the music between the pieces. You guys rock. And thanks to the guy who teaches them and who organized this, Mr. Robert Apostle.
And let's begin.
Message 3.
This is Sean Mackey at Stanford University. So, looks like the credits.
This is Jana.
This is Steve Strogatz.
Radiolab is produced by Jad.
I call him Dad, and Kristen calls him Chad, but his real name is Jad Abumrad.
Our staff includes
Alan Horn.
Alan Horn.
Lauren Wheeler.
Lauren Wheeler.
Sean Cole.
Sean Cole.
Pat Walters.
Pat Walters.
Tim Howard.
Tim Howard.
Brenna Farrell.
Brenna Farrell.
And Lynn Levy.
And Lynn Levy.
Levy.
With help from Jonathan Mitchell.
Douglas Q. Smith. Kristen Clark.
Rose Epeleth. Rachel James.
And Matt Keatley. Kilty. Darn.
Special thanks to Joe Fragola
and Dr. Elliot Crane. Bye, guys. I'm calling from Jerry Diddy.
End of mailbox.